Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is the 21st of September and it is episode 78. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be it's going to be an in-house show this week. A lot of IPA getting to know each other, I guess.
Yeah, it's not as creepy as that sounds.
So we're going to be talking to Andrew Bushnell, IPA Research Fellow, doing a lot of work on criminal justice. Going to be talking about his upcoming report on victims' rights. Really interesting conversation. It's an issue that I didn't really know a whole lot about. Doesn't really get discussed. But it doesn't get discussed because there's not a lot of precedent for it, which might institute the Bushnell principle.
Well, launched today on the Young IPA podcast, a new legal principle that will change the world.
Yep.
Like the rule of law.
Spot the lie. And we're also going to be talking to IPA research fellow Matthew Lesh. He is the author of the upcoming book, Democracy in a Divided Australia.
Yeah, Lesh wrote a book.
Yeah, he did. And does he think he's better than us or something?
Wow.
So we're going to be talking to him about that, about what he sees as the divided Australia, how we can get things back on the right path, and what it means. Because Pete and I, he divides it between inners and outers, and Pete and I do not fall into either category. So what does that mean?
Because we're unique characters.
Yes. Like a snowflake. Like there's no...
Like a beautiful snowflake.
Yeah. There's no recreation of us.
Yeah. We're special.
Yeah. cool. So let's get into it, Pete. You start off.
Okay, I'll start off.
That's my ease transition into Peter Gregory's speech. Yeah, it's just me stuttering going, you start.
Silky smooth from James. Thanks for that, mate. So we saw a story emerge in the United States this week that the deregulation... what would you call it, program of the Trump government has saved American taxpayers $1.3 billion. That's a piece of research from the American Action Forum. This was, so as you would remember, Executive Order 13771 from Trump, which demanded that federal... You'd remember that one.
Like it was yesterday.
It was a good order. It was much better than 13770. So this or executive order demanded that federal agencies repeal two existing regulations for every one created, and this has obviously resulted in heaps of regulations being removed. They did note that $1.3 billion in savings was double the goal because the Obama administration had underestimated how much regulation was costing the American taxpayers.
Yeah, big surprise. $1.3 billion saved based on the one-in, two-out rule. So
that's it. Yeah.
So Australia should pursue that.
Should cut red tape, as the IPA has been talking about.
Absolutely. You can read a bit more about that through our Hey What Did I Miss email yesterday. Another story that we want to talk about. So this one coming out of the UK. So free speech is so dead in the UK. Oh. So last week we were talking about how South Yorkshire police were asking people to come forward with non-hate crime incidents. Still bizarre to me. This week, Labour Party MP Lucy Powell from Manchester Central, she's putting forward a bill in Parliament, and basically she's written an op-ed in The Guardian accompanying the bill and just sort of talking about what the issues are. So she says, you may wonder what could bring Nicky Morgan, and it goes to all these people, Jacob Rees-Mogg, one of my favourites. It's very alarming that he's being mentioned in this article.
That's a huge surprise.
Her bill... I'll quote here from the Guardian article. That's why I'm introducing a bill in Parliament which will do by establishing legal accountability for what's published in large online forums. I believe we can force those who run these echo chambers on online groups to stamp out the evil that is currently so prominent. So basically, on Facebook, we all are a member of secret groups, mainly memes, and there's some that are probably worse than others and spreading, some pretty out there opinions. And she goes, because these groups just get rid of people that don't agree with a group, it can normalize hate, and therefore the government needs to get involved.
Yeah, it's crazy.
The fact that this bill even is about to be introduced in Parliament is such a terrifying, terrifying thing.
Well, the idea that a person in Parliament can think that it's completely within the rights of government to... govern the things people say in their private groups. That's what she's saying, that in their private groups where, it's invite only, not everyone can see it. Well, what could they possibly say? They might be saying hateful things. Yep. We need to govern that.
The online version of a dinner party. The government just saying, we need to crash your dinner party. We don't know what's being said over that.
And one of the things she says in justification is that because at a dinner party, you'll have the decent people there saying things back to these crazy ideas and these hateful ideas, which is... in and of itself. The idea that people online don't agree with each other, I don't know if she's been online for a while, but...
it's a bit of a hotbed of disagreement.
Yeah. So,
the other, look. The other part of it for me is, like, if there's one way to convince people that they're wrong, it is by not allowing them to post online.
Yeah.
Like, that's the way they go, maybe you're onto something here.
Let's push neo-Nazis further underground.
Yeah.
Where their stupid ideas can fester further.
Yeah, yeah. And then this led to, leaping off of this. So Brendan O'Neill, friend of the show, he was on a few weeks ago, had an article in Reason, the US think tank's blog, talking about how 9 people are arrested a day in Britain for online posting. Offensive online posting. 9 people a day.
As I told you during the week, James, that is 3,285 people a year.
All right, calculator boy. that is... Yeah. Insanity, though.
The fact that 3,000 people in Britain are getting arrested every day, every year for stuff they write online,
yeah,
that's extraordinary.
And the other part of it is, of course, there is absolutely nothing that the British police need to concern themselves about right now.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like London being the knife capital crime of the world.
That's right. And they should even go out there and invite more crime so they can get those numbers up.
Yep, exactly. That's go with those non-crime hate incidents.
That's what she's put this up for. It's because she's concerned they're not arresting enough people.
That's it. Yeah. Well, because they're not going after the actual crimes that are being committed. Let's move on to another one. So let's bring it back to Australia, Pete. There was a pretty incredible graph out of Catalexy Files yesterday.
That's right. So Catalexy Files, which is a wonderful blog for those who don't look at it. There's a lot of people that contribute to it. It's really good. Check it out.
Edited by our friend, Professor Sinclair Davidson.
That's right. Good friend of me, one of my supervisors. Catalexy, for though it's spelled C-A-T-A-L-L.
On the PhD, not just in general.
Yeah. Just like strictly PhD supervisor. So Catalexy Files, look up what Catalexy means. I can't remember. It's really good. Anyway, the graph is about public servants and how much we pay for them and all that stuff. So we have 1,956,800 public servants at last count, which was in 2017. That number includes local, state and Commonwealth public servants. It does not include outsourced government workers or, what are they called, consultants. So, there are more people. Now, the interesting thing about this stat, not only has it kept going up forever, it is actually larger than the state of South Australia.
And 4 times that of Tasmania.
4 times that of Tasmania. So, for those playing at home, South Australia has 1.677 million people, and South Australia only has 515,000 people. Great place for a holiday, though. Check it out. So,
not as many wineries in the public service.
What's that? I'm sorry?
Not as many wineries in the public service. If you had to choose a holiday between South Australia and the public service.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not as many wineries.
Yeah, that's true. So, look, this is what I mean, right? I've been saying, banging on about this a bit, and I don't normally bang on about stuff.
No, absolutely not.
There's plenty of red tape. There's plenty of low-hanging fruit for this government. We've got a really good story in the United States of this thing happening, and we've seen employment go up, and obviously there's a lot of reasons for that. But part of it's the low tax, low regulation thing. Now, that's a great story to tell. I don't understand why it's so difficult for our government to say we're going to do it too.
Well, because remember that time that Trump wrote Covfefe?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's basically it.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Plus hate.
Yeah. Don't want that.
Well, look, you've got the mind of a political operative, James.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I know that's definitely a compliment coming from you. All right, so we'll get through some of the stuff that the IPA has been doing about this week. So we talked about this earlier in the show. So Matthew Lesh, IPA research fellow here, written the new book, Democracy in a Divided Australia. So you can go pre-order that from our friends at Connacourt Publishing. There's also 2 events. So make sure you're on the Generation Liberty Facebook page for the event in Melbourne. And on the 27th of September, if you're in Brisbane, there's going to be a launch with Connacourt Publishing. And a few words said by Senator Amanda Stoker. We're going to be talking to Lesh much more in depth about that book later in the show, so stick around for that. So we've got 2 op-eds coming out this morning, being Friday. So we've got John Roskam in the Australian Financial Review talking about some of the issues that are facing the Liberal Party at the moment. I come back to the Liberal Party had that leadership challenge. There was all this debate about, you know, getting the leadership party back to getting the Liberal Party back to its roots, standing up for liberal causes. So it's very, very relaxing that the number one issue facing them right now is gender quotas.
Yeah, it
really tells me that they figured out what's wrong.
That seems like the right fit to me.
Yeah. So John's going to be talking about gender quotas and also about workplace bullying. I'll just share this paragraph here because I thought it was just that good. So Liberal MPs should stop and ponder the consequences of their bullying claims for not only victims of bullying, but for anyone else accused of bullying. One of the Liberal senators said of the leadership dispute, everything was happening so fast, and that within itself is a form of intimidation because we were supposed to make a very important decision within a very short amount of time. Presumably from now on, any employee anywhere when asked to make an important decision too quickly would be entitled to be claimed that they were intimidated.
Yeah.
Yeah, that Liberal senator could never have come on this podcast. Like, there are some snap decisions that are made. And
what about when we have to decide quickly to sort of capitalise Prime Minister in Hay or not?
Oh, that's, yeah.
That's pulling.
The golden hour, which is 3 to 4 o'clock of, hey, what did I miss? Yeah. There are some very quick decisions being made.
We like this in capitals. Yeah.
Well, Peter and I basically bully each other all Thursday and Friday.
And the other days in the week too.
That's a lot of text messages that go around on the weekends.
Yeah.
So you can go read that.
The thing I loved about that piece, and I haven't got the paragraph because I didn't do that, is that when John at the end says, you know, if we're going to have a quota for women, then where does it end? Maybe we should have a quota for Christians too. How would that go down? He writes a lot better than I just said it. So check out the article.
But it wouldn't go down well, to the point.
That's the point, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So we've also got Dr. Bella De Barra, a great friend of the show. She is in the Daily Telegraph. And I think it also got shared on the Herald Sun website as well, talking about the national curriculum changes and basically what's going on there, why it should sound alarm bells for any listeners we have who are young parents.
That's right. And Bella, me, and Lesh actually share a cubicle. Mm-hmm. She's written 5 books. Lesh has written 1. And I'm stuck on donuts.
Yeah, but that PhD is so close.
Well, see, that's a form of bullying because they're better than me writing books.
But do they go for Melbourne?
No.
So
there you go.
I bring it back.
Bella
to that.
Hates footy, so what does that even mean?
Well, can we trust it with these books?
That's right.
All right, so that is it for the show at the start. We'll now go to our interviews with Andrew and Matthew. But before we do that, I just want to say thank you guys so much for listening and subscribing. We're available on iTunes, Podbean, Spotify. You can also download us through Pocket Casts or whatever it is. So, you know, if you're listening, obviously you already know that. But if you have friends who aren't listening and they want to get in touch, maybe they never really had iTunes, there are so many ways that they can get involved with the podcast. Make sure you're telling them about that and make sure they're subscribing. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you're leaving us that 5-star review. Very easy to do with the new iOS system. All you need to go is to the podcast page and just scroll down and it'll ask you to leave a review. The 5-star reviews have been coming very quickly the last couple of weeks, so let's keep that going.
They're on.
Very quickly.
Cool.
Very, very quickly.
Thanks, listeners.
All right, so Nina, pressing the buttons for us as always and doing a magnificent job. Nina, how can people take a more financial part of the IPA?
Just visit the website, ipa.org.au, and you can help us by joining as a member or donates. If you click on the join button, you can become a member starting as low as $22 per year and become part of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Very cool. All right, let's go to those interviews now. Okay, we now welcome back onto the show one of our favourites, IPA Research Fellow Matthew Lesh. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
All right, cool. So let's get straight into it. If I may, Pete.
Go for it.
You're about to say something.
Shoot.
Cool. Sorry, Matthew. You are the upcoming author of a book, your first book, Democracy in a Divided Australia. Do you want to tell us about the book?
Sure. And just like everybody else, I too am shocked that I've written a book.
I feel you would have cottoned onto something in the build up.
It kind of just happened. Like, I just woke up one morning and there's 50,000 words.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's being printed. It's a strange
big
experience.
Night.
Yeah.
You know, I
wish I did that in a big night.
Finished your PhD.
Yeah. Come on, Pete. So Democracy in Divided Australia, I suppose, really has three main themes in it. The first one is that it looks at this idea that Australia is divided between what I call the inners and the outers, which is, I suppose, superseding the kind of traditional class divisions in Australian politics. So historically, really, you could basically predict someone's vote based upon their social identity as either working or middle class, or their kind of career, whether they, you know, manual job or non-manual job.
Yeah.
And so the middle class people would vote Liberal, National kind of thing, and then working class people vote Labour.
But I used to base it on phrenology. I was really into that. Like, you could predict someone's vote through the size of their skull. I've got some tools back home from the former days, so we could perform another few tests.
I don't know
that's
what
my
he's on about.
This is like the
phrenology.
Kind of,
Google it.
This
is
like the, you know, early 19th century kind of eugenics of the web.
Of course, you don't know what I'm talking about. You've got a mole beneath your right eye, Pete.
So what we've seen in the last 50 years, and it was David Kemp, was that really the first one to point this out in Australia, is a decline in that class voting. And I suppose what political science would call a new cleavage or a new divide in Australian politics is between these inners, who are the kind of highly educated, progressive, cosmopolitan class, who value kind of change and diversity, who tend to live in the centre of Australia's cities, doing professional managerial jobs have come to really dominate Australian society, be it universities or the media or politics or bureaucracy or whatever else. But they're really a minority in Australia despite their domination. And the other side, you have what I call the adders, which are the more, grounded traditionalist people who really base their identity not so much on their professional or educational achievements, but on where they grew up, on their local community identity, their family, their national identity, and that really drives a different set of political values, particularly on kind of cultural issues about what is the role of teaching Australian history and what should we think of ourselves and as a nation? Should we be proud of ourselves as a nation, or should we be ashamed of our past? And then you see this kind of really driving, a renewed culture war sort of debate in Australia. So that's the first point, is kind of understand that divide and understand that that divide really overlaps the parties, which is making politics itself more difficult, because the major parties have to try to speak to Western Sydney at the same time as Wentworth, in the case of the Liberal Party, or the really Labor Party had this quite pronounced divide between their inner city Greens constituency, which they need to kind of go more progressive on issues like refugees, but then they've also got their kind of suburban working class, trades voting Labourites that still exists. So this divide is really complicating Australian politics. That's the first point. The second point really looks at the way in which particularly inners have come to dominate the way we make policy in Australia. So this is the notion which increasingly kind of the inner disposition is towards kind of paternalism and technocracy, which is that if you've been created a class system, not necessarily based on income, but based on your professional and educational achievements, and you said that gives me social status, well, doesn't really take that long to then say, well, then I should be able to govern over other people, and I should be able to decide what food they're able to eat. I should be able to regulate their lives through independent regulatory agencies. Now, the problem isn't necessarily that with expert-driven policymaking per se, but it's the idea that if you have all your experts come from a similar kind of inner perspective on what is appropriate and inappropriate behaviour, what are good and bad values, you're going to have a sense of bias at the elite levels of policymaking towards control of people's lives. And then that's going to naturally drive quite substantial political frustrations amongst outers and the sense in which the policymaking elite is quite disconnected from the Australian public. We have something like 2/3 of Australians think that politicians are just in it for themselves. About a quarter of Australians think that the Australian democracy is working very well. We've got these kind of intermingled trends really, I think, driving the craziness we see in Australian politics. And then the final point of the book is to try to say, well, what now? So we've got a problem, we've got a divide, but how do you respond to it? And what I do in the book is outline what I call liberal populism. So it's trying to, take the best elements of populism, which is its sense in which there is something wrong with an elite-driven politic in which people feel like they have no say, but then having a kind of individualist, liberal, pluralist response to that, which is saying, well, both inners and outers are legitimate parts of Australia's public debate. They should both be able to fully express their opinions and their perspectives, and they should be really given more freedom to decide within their own lives what they do, within their own family lives and within their own communities. So a big part of this, for example, is localism, which is providing power back to communities to make decisions about what is taught in their schools or the way that policing is delivered or the local control of their hospitals, which is to really empower both inners and outers rather than having this zero-sum game in which we war in Canberra between divided politics.
Right. So one of the things you're doing as part of a marketing is on, I think it's australiadivided.com.
Yes.
There's going to be a quiz and you can take it to see whether you're an inner or an outer. Now, Pete and I both did the quiz yesterday.
It was tough.
Very searching questions. We went deep within ourselves.
It's not too tough though. Your listeners should definitely do it.
That was a joke. There's like 9 questions. It's really fun. But Pete and I are both in-betweeners. Mm. Now, does that make us superior beings or just fantastic beings?
I think it means we're everymen.
Yeah.
We can connect with people of all stripes.
Yes.
So
Corinthians.
So the idea of inners and outers, I suppose, is a bit of a simplification of the dynamic in Australian politics. One thing I talk a little bit about in the book is this idea of betweeners, which is people who have kind of a mixture of instincts on both the inner and outer side.
Yeah.
It probably means you have a greater between us, I'm not going to say anyone is superior to anyone else because ultimately we're all
morally
we're morally equal as individuals.
Oh, I'm superior. Sorry, just for the record.
I mean, that really sounds like inner talk.
Look, I'm in between. I have some inner things and then I have some outer things. I both think I'm superior and I think I'm a jerk for thinking that. So there you go.
Very self-aware. Very self-aware. Come out in the book as an inner, and I also come out in my survey as an inner. But I like to think of myself as a self-aware inner, which might even be the next level arrogance of an inner.
I like that.
Yeah.
Which is to say that appreciate that not everyone has the same worldview as me, and that there is diversity of perspective. So the quiz really, really comes out to simplify and I suppose get people thinking about the kind of issues that split inners and outers, be it their sense of identity and their connection to nation.
Civic pride seemed to be a recurring theme in the quiz.
Civic pride is a big one there, kind of reactions to immigration. Australia Day. What defines a lot of these things is the fact that the sense of self-identity is quite important here, which is that if you base your identity on your educational and professional achievements, like inners do, you have a lot less need or appreciation for kind of an identity based on your sense of place and location. So the inners often go further and are quite disparaging of Australian culture and Australian identity, which is then taken on as with a high level of meaning by inners. And we see this around issues like Australia Day, or even the sense in which someone, you know, wearing a flag, they must inherently be racist if you're kind of got a mindset. Those kind of issues, I think, tap into that different sense of identity and belonging and
Southern
sense of
Cross
meaning.
Tattoo, I feel, would also be another one.
That would probably be a more of an outer.
Like the judgment of seeing
exactly.
Like that,
exactly.
If you wear an Australian flag at Big Day Out, you're an outer. If you wear an Australian flag at the World Cup, you're an inner.
What about the Australian Open? You see a lot of that.
Outer. Yep.
Okay, cool. We got that on the record.
Could I ask you a question about liberal populism, though?
Sure.
So is that, am I being optimistic when I think that that is kind of our natural inclination as a country? Or is that just me wanting that to be true?
I hope so. I mean, I think in terms of the natural, you know, my assumption of the natural implication of Australians is that we've got this, what's called a Benthamite utilitarian, which is that I think most Australians are relatively practical in the way they think about policy and want an idea of what provides the greatest benefits, the greatest number.
Okay.
But I do think there are strikes of liberal, kind of what I describe liberal populism in Australian history. I mean, if you look at Eureka, which I think is something that's an underappreciated part of Australian history, it was really a movement, an anti-tax movement of the diggers at Eureka against a very kind of elitist government based in Melbourne, and their sense in which they're getting slapped with these higher and higher taxes. Now, of course, in the immediate sense, the Eureka Stockaders lost the battle, but ultimately, because of sympathy in Melbourne, they won the war, and you saw a movement towards democracy, very liberal form of 19th century democracy in Australia. I also refer to the book of the little known, but even less known than Eureka, Great Confederated Anti-Dray Tax League of South Australia, which was of 18...
Not as catchy. It's the Eureka Rebellion.
What's their flag look like?
I don't think they made a flag, but so they're talking 1850 South Australia here, and you've got these group of people who the governors put in place a tax on drays.
Yeah,
and a dray is like
a
horse-drawn carriage.
I remember from when I was a child. So.
I'm an inner.
I didn't know what it was either. Don't worry.
Yep.
So then, what they did though is that bigger drays, which were used by the kind of farmers of the colony, would receive a higher tax than the smaller drays, which were used by the aristocrats who didn't have as much to carry around. There was a massive rebellion. You've got dozens of leagues across the colony against this particular tax, which was imposed by a legislator that not yet did everyone have a vote in, only the aristocrats did. Ultimately, the rebellion was so strong against them that the governor not only repealed the tax, but they refunded everyone who'd paid it. So I think that's a case of liberal populism. And they even use phrases like no taxation without representation, borrowing from the American revolutionaries, and had some amazing rhetoric about daring to be free Englishmen against the totalitarian rule of the state governor. So I guess you do have a little bit of little bit of liberal populism.
We should start including that in our anti-tax stuff at the IPA. Not only should you cut tax, but you should pay it back.
Ooh.
Agreed.
Yeah, that'd be big. Cool. So that's it for the book. So it's Democracy in Divided Australia. You can get it from Concord Publishing, or pre-order it from Concord.
Indeed.
When is publication?
So publication is Saturday, the 29th of September. So that's just a over day. A week away. Yeah.
And there's a few event launches that we want to plug. Yeah. Sorry, 27th of September, I think, or October. Or...
27th of September, we're doing a launch. That's this Thursday up in Brisbane. We're doing a launch with Senator Amanda Stoker.
Yep.
You can find out more details online, or we can put in the show notes.
I think it's it's public. It's like you can book through Concord Publishing. Has a lot of links to it. There's also a lot of links in some of the Hey What Did I Miss emails. We've got that. Yeah. So if you're subscribed, well, you can just go to our website, look up the Hey What Did I Miss that we've uploaded. They'll all be there.
Yeah.
And then there's a Generation Liberty event.
We've got a Generation Liberty is hosting the Melbourne launch very graciously with Senator James Patterson on the 5th of October, Friday the 5th of October, and you can check out the Generation Liberty Facebook page for more details on that.
All right, brilliant. So let's move on to another subject. So Bettina Arndt is a speaker and writer, and she was giving a speech at La Trobe University, I think it is, maybe
University of Sydney.
She's done both.
She's done both, and both have been marred by controversy. So do you want to explain what happened?
Sure. So Bettina is a sex therapist by trade, and she partakes in the debate about what is happening on campus in related to sexual harassment and sexual assault, which is obviously a very controversial subject. So initially she was planning on speaking at La Trobe. That was cancelled by La Trobe in the first instance, who then embarrassingly backflipped and said that they'll be just charging security fees after... some pressure was put onto La Trobe. They backflipped again and said that they would provide security. And then the event went ahead, was attended by, I think, quite a decent audience of 40, 50, 60 people on campus, but aggressively protest to the point where people were slamming on the doors halfway, all the way through it, trying to interrupt it, stop it from happening, saying that she should get kicked off campus because she's somehow making people feel unsafe, like merely expressing an idea makes people unsafe. The great irony, of course, of this was that after her talk, there were a lot of people in the room actually who were there to question her and oppose her, which I think is a very good sign of healthy debate. But it was actually impossible to hear the questioners or her answers because the banging on the door was so loud. So literally these protesters are in themselves preventing the process of free speech and debate and challenge of Bettina's ideas. So then Bettina is doing a little bit of a tour on this, and she was up in Sydney, it was last week, giving a similar speech. And of course, the socialists at Sydney University are some of the most aggressively, viciously revolting people on the planet. And I don't say that lightly, and I say that with experience after we did.
I started twitching as you said that.
they're really, inners, aren't they?
It really came from somewhere.
I say this after the Generation Liberty debate we did against them, which they literally broke all the rules we pre-agreed to.
Inners or outers?
The socialists. Mm. I'm gonna say inners.
Hardcore inners.
Pretty hardcore inners. Anyway, so they decided to protest her again, which very kind of violently and aggressively led to the riot squad being called to Sydney University. So a really great sign for the state of free debate. And I think it's actually quite worthwhile just very quickly unpacking the supposed justifications for these protests, which is that so the Trobe Student Union put out a statement saying that she should be prevented from campus. Now, kicked off campus, and there was basically all couched in the language of safety and safetyism, and then in the sense in which having her makes people feel bad. Now, not only is this a real historical transformation, because it used to be students who were the ones who would push the boundaries of acceptable speech on campus, particularly even a quite a radical campus like La Trobe, you've now got this world in which students are appealing to authority in order to prevent somebody from being heard in the first place. And they're doing it because really they lacking in a sense in which ideas and debate is necessary, and that sometimes hurt feelings are necessary in the process of discovering what is true and developing your thinking and your thoughts. And that even does mean hearing people you fundamentally disagree with, like Bettina or Milo or whoever else, in order to really comprehend a different perspective and being able to respond to it properly. And that's something we really have to fight against, this idea that feelings are more important than debate, and particularly on campus.
Absolutely. So Matthew Lesh, author of upcoming book, Democracy in a Divided Australia, pre-order now. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Cool. Okay, we now welcome back to the show one of our favorites, IPA research fellow, Andrew Bushnell. He's just eating a mincey. I'm padding for him right now. Pete, how are you going?
I'm really good. Bushnell
just
always
wanted to make sure that my throat was thoroughly lubricated.
Yeah, well, so you're a true professional.
Yeah.
And loved by the punters, as he always tells me.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, so Bushnell, you've got a very cool research report coming up pretty soon on victims' rights. Now, do you want to explain what that concept is?
Yeah, so over the last 30, 40 years, there's been this shift across common law countries like ours, and particularly in the United States, to give victims of crime more rights in the criminal justice process. So the criminal justice process is, in our country, an adversarial process. So it has two parties, and the goal isn't really to find the truth as such. It's to come to a decision about justice based on the cases that are presented both for and against the accused. But this kind of, the criminal law, I'll go back a step. The criminal law, so a crime is like a moral wrong. That's what separates the criminal law from the civil law.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you sue someone for like installing a bad bathroom in your house or something.
Good example.
That's not a crime. Yeah. Well, that's actually something that happened to my parents.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, that's embarrassing.
Yeah, it's really specific. And then you go, you know, and you get a judgment against them in a tribunal, and then they can't afford to pay, and you never see a cent. And no.
Bloody builders.
Not a crime.
Even we're running then, long today, Pete.
Even then, not a crime. What makes a crime is that there's this like moral component to it. It's the community's judgment about what's really, really wrong. And because it has that community public aspect, crimes are traditionally prosecuted by the state. But of course, that excludes the victim. So in any crime, there's two victims. There's the person who is directly affected, and then there's the community. And at the moment, it's the prosecutor is representing that second group, the community. And so the argument has always been, or at least for the last couple of generations, that this excludes victims. So victims' rights is the idea that we need to incorporate the victim into this process a bit more. And so I've been looking at how that works in Australia. And I've come to a recommendation about a kind of a minor fix that would give victims one more right, but without affecting this traditional adversarial process that we have.
And right. What is that?
So my idea is that we give victims the right to trigger an appeal against a manifestly inadequate sentence. So from time to time, you see these cases where the sentence handed down is actually wildly lenient. And they don't happen that often, but when they do, they generate a lot of attention. And the Director of Public Prosecutions, and in some states the Attorney General, has the power to go to the Court of Appeal and have this sentence reassessed based on the idea that wording is manifestly inadequate, and that means that it wasn't actually a sentence available to the sentencing judge under the law, that it was so wildly out of step with community expectations that it just simply shouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so my idea is that the trigger for that, for going to the Court of Appeal, could be extended from the DPP to victims themselves. So it wouldn't be one in place of the other, but it would be another finger on the trigger, if you like, so that victims could say, no, I'm sorry, that sentence really doesn't meet my expectations. And then you're using the victim there as a proxy for community standards. And the idea is basically to make judges in sentencing more sensitive to community standards. And the statistical basis for that is that over the last 10 years, the number of appeals against sentence by the DPP or Attorneys General has gone down across the country. So their sentences aren't being tested enough. That's my thesis.
Right. Okay. And what, like, so that seems like a pretty straight up and down home run for me. So why don't we have it already?
Well, the argument against it, the main risk, is that you would end up flooding the Court of Appeals with a number of appeals against sentence
right.
that don't have any chance of succeeding. So the legal standard is actually quite high. To mitigate that risk, I'm suggesting that the DPP, which already reviews every sentence as a matter of course, so every time the DPP acts in a case, it reviews the sentence, it just makes that advice available to victims so that victims can make a decision. So the DPP could say to a victim, look, you have this right, but just know that when we present this at the Court of Appeal, it's not likely to get up. And another step that I would add in is that it wouldn't go direct to the Court of Appeal. It would go you'd have to beg leave to appeal. So there'd be a preliminary hearing where the Court of Appeal would consider how strong the appeal is. And then if you get past that hurdle. But the idea isn't necessarily that there would be more successful appeals, but that there would be more appeals in a way that, such that, you know, sentencing judges would have to be more sensitive, that they would know in the back of their minds, actually, it's more likely than it used to be that my sentence could be reviewed by the Court of Appeal. And that means I need to pay more attention to victims as a proxy for community standards.
I assume this happens elsewhere in the world, maybe some states in America.
As I've outlined it just now, this would actually be novel.
Oh, wow.
So this is the way people always say this in politics is, this is a chance for Victoria to lead the world.
I was literally just about to say that.
You know, because in Australia...
We copy everything else, so this is good.
In Australia, we love international comparisons. It doesn't matter what it is. In this criminal justice project that I do here at the IPA, the most successful report I put out was an international comparison of costs because people love it. It's like a league table. It's like, are we winning or are we losing?
Yeah.
This is a chance to be really at the cutting edge. Now, there is something similar...
The Bushnell Principle could be an international legal tradition.
It's sort of based on a right that they have in India. But that right extends to plea bargains. So when someone agrees to plead guilty to a lesser charge, it applies to restitution orders when the judge orders compensation be paid and then the victim has a right in India to say, well, that's not enough. Why do I know that? Well... Earlier this year, I did something.
You got that dump button, Nina?
Earlier this year, I did something somewhat crazy. I was flying to Peru with my wife, where she's from, and to save money, we decided to fly. via Canada to get to Peru.
Not traditionally on the way.
And in my defense, it was a significant saving. It was about 50% of the cost of the ticket.
Wow. Yes,
but at huge. Time cost, and we had this layover in Toronto on the way back. And you're allowed in Toronto if you have a long layover, they let you out of the airport. You get a cheap train ticket to go to the city center. So anyway, we went there and it was freezing cold. It was 0 degrees. And so we paid a taxi driver just to drive us around to some of the tourist spots. And I get in this taxi and the guy says to me, what do you do? And I stupidly told him the truth. And I said, you know, I work in criminal justice. And he goes, oh, now, he said to me literally like this, now you are going to get a lecture about criminal law.
Cabbies don't usually want to give their opinion on stuff like that.
And he started talking about, he was an immigrant from India, and he started talking about, and he had a run-in with the Canadian criminal justice system of some sort that he didn't detail. And he was comparing it to the justice system in India. And I'm there and I'm struggling listening to this guy. Melissa, my wife, is sitting next to me and she starts tapping the sign where it has like a passenger's bill of rights. And there's a line in it that says, you have the right to a silent cab ride.
That's a human right I can get behind. We're talking about positive human rights. That's a positive human right I can get behind.
My wife's tapping this thing and I'm like struggling to humor this guy. And then at some point he says, in India, the victim has the right to appeal a sentence.
Yeah.
And then he keeps talking and I go, wait, mate, back up. That bit's interesting. Let's get into that. And so he starts telling me about this. Now, of course, it turns out he didn't have the law exactly right, which is why you always verify legal advice you get in cabs. I find that that's a rule worth living by.
Yeah, I know from experience.
But it set us down this path. And I think it's a really interesting reform. It's like, it's kind of a modest reform. It's not a huge... The idea here is to empower victims in a way that is meaningful, to actually give them agency, a decision to make, but in a way that preserves the adversarial system. Because what I found in my reading for this is that a more expansive victims' rights agenda, like we've seen across the Western world over the last 40 years, is actually a kind of a, I don't want to say sneaky or backdoor attempt to move the adversarial system that we have in English-speaking countries towards a more inquisitorial system that you would see in continental Europe. So the idea here is almost like a third way, middle path reform that tries to hit both goals.
I know I've been talking about this topic for a long time, but I want one more question. What are the kind of other stuff they do for victims' rights in other places, parts of the world? You sort of just...
So, for example, about 15 years ago, I want to say, 14 years ago, in the United States, federal court system, they implemented a right that victims would have the right to independent counsel, and their counsel could be a party to proceedings to move motions and things like that. So that almost like creates a three-cornered system where you have the state prosecutor and you have the defendant, and then you have this counsel representing the victim.
Mm-hmm.
So that's obviously a much more dramatic reform. Other victims' rights things that we have, so every state in Australia allows victims to make a victim impact statement. There's some debate about whether judges can actually take that into account in sentencing, because it's technically not evidence. Or at least not all of it is evidence, so they often have to edit these. And the point that I would make about that is that although that has a cathartic effect for victims, or can have, it doesn't give them any decision-making power. It's not actually a kind of agency.
Yeah.
And I think that's... I would try and shift the discussion a little bit from therapeutic actions for victims towards something concrete but non-distortive that victims can do to participate in the trials that affect them.
So, like, when the videos from that gymnast coach that was, doing terrible things with some of the people he was supposed to be looking after in the US, and, like, there was just girl after girl talking about what it was, and it was, like, this really cathartic thing, went really viral, it was very therapeutic for a lot of people, but they would also be able to have a say on sentencing as well.
Yeah, exactly. So This isn't an either-or. This is more... I mean, I do think victim impact statements are worthwhile, but I'm just saying, in addition to that, let's try and create a decision that victims can make, and that might increase that therapeutic effect.
Cool. So law and order is going to have a huge, and criminal justice is going to have a huge impact on the upcoming Victorian election. So we've got a lot of stories going on in the news right now. Simon Breeny was on A Current Affair recently talking about how the Victorian public and the relationship between the Victorian public and the Victorian police is pretty much at an all-time low. What do you think are going to be some of the big issues, criminal justice-wise, in the upcoming Victorian elections?
I think the main one is that the government is going to say crime is falling. And that's true if you look over the last 12 to 18 months, but that's down from a spike that happened in the first half of Andrew's term as Premier. So it depends on the timeline, but the thing is, you don't want to pull that timeline back too far, because you'll find that the previous Liberal government didn't necessarily have the best record either. But I think that's going to be the argument. They're going to say, no, we're on top of it now. We've hired extra police. We're building a new prison down at Lara, which is something that I'm interested in, because our argument is that we need to be thinking harder about reducing incarceration in a safe way to avoid things like this new prison at Lara is going to cost $700 million. That's the sticker price. We all know how when things get built here in Victoria, it end up costing a lot more. I don't expect anyone to raise that cost as an election issue.
You can't wear a hard hat and point at machinery in front of a slight reform to the criminal justice movement.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's the optics of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, my argument is that being tough on crime actually means reducing crime overall. It means making our streets safer. And if that means being smarter about how we punish criminals, in particular about reforming community corrections to get people into work and skills training so that they're more likely to get a job when they're back out, free and out of the system, then we should do that. I mean, I would consider that to be tough on crime compared to ever-increasing costs, managing the escalation of crime, and just accepting sort of with a shrug that we're just going to all have to put up with streets that aren't as safe as they used to be.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, cool. So we'll have a look out for that one. That's going to be coming up in the next few weeks. So they work on victims' rights. So have a look at that on the IPA website.
The Andrew's principle. Yeah, Andrew principle.
The Bushnell principle.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, Bushnell.
Need to work. Cool. So let's talk about something else, something very near and dear to Bushnell and my heart. So we're running late in the interview, but I just do want to get... By the time most people listen to the show, the match will have happened, Richmond v Collingwood. Bushnell and I, absolute mad Richmond fans.
People look forward to this coming out, James.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, how are we feeling?
Pretty confident. Although, I mean, the two games against Collingwood this year have been quite close, and you could make the argument that we only really won because of some injuries to Collingwood that happened throughout the four quarters. So,
as a lot of my Collingwood fan friends have been saying.
Yeah, I wanted to avoid Collingwood and Pete's team Melbourne in the finals, and now it looks like we might have to beat them both to win the premiership. Ooh,
wow. Don't be still my beating heart.
Just because they're the two teams that actually attack properly, like down the corridor, they go fast, have the ability to change the pace of the game, whereas West Coast is a bit more one-paced, a bit easier for our defence. So
they are the one of the three teams. Like, of those three teams, they're the only one that beat Richmond. I'm still a bit scared of West Coast.
They beat us in Perth
by 50. It was a bit of a smack.
Doesn't count over there. Unless it's a prelim. We love trouble. Anyway, just to paint a word picture for our listeners, whilst you've been listening to these, you know, in-depth legal arguments and, in fact, a whole new way of dealing with victims' rights, Bushnell is sitting here in a Richmond hoodie. Like the biggest, Richmond footy bogan you can imagine. I did read in the Herald Sun this morning that apparently in the 20s, before Richmond played Collingwood in a grand final, police had to break up fights between gangs on the border of those two suburbs. So a big rivalry.
Well, I live near the Collingwood Clifton Hill borderline, so yeah. I might start a few. I'll be the distracting movement, lure their forces north, and then the Richmond fans can come in through the south.
I can very clearly remember the first time I ever saw Richmond actually beat Collingwood.
Yeah?
1994 at the MCG, we won by 66 points, and all the Collingwood fans were leaving early, and it was the first time in my life where we got to like wave at the opposition fans as they left early.
And it was another 17 years until we were able to do it again.
Well, I mean, to that point, I think I'd seen Richmond win like maybe five or six games in my whole life. And then we suddenly won this game. We just started piling on goals, and it was like the best day of my life.
There you go. We're talking about football for our non-Victorian listeners.
Yeah, yeah. My last thing I'll say about this is last year, it was every game was just, I'm happy to be here. Like, Richmond could have lost and I would have been okay. But this year, expectations really stink. I don't know how Hawthorn fans do it.
I'll be hurt if we don't win.
Like, Hawthorn and Geelong fans, get in the emails. Like, how do you do this every year? Like, the expectations and like...
Wow. Obviously didn't do it this year, but...
Well, I'm just saying, for like the last 10 years, they went up to finals games thinking like, we will win this. It'll be weird if we didn't.
Yeah,
but we'll be super bitter next time we're back in the bottom four.
It'll be terrible. Anyway, Bushnell, thank you so much for joining
us. Cheers, thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you to Andrew and Matthew for those interviews. Really interesting chats. Make sure you're pre-ordering Matthew's book.
In-house this week.
Yes.
It's all right.
It's good.
Nothing wrong with a staycation.
Look, yes, but I've really enjoyed it. So let's get into some stories that made us laugh this week. And I might start off with one of the good friends of the podcast. It's got a special place in this podcast heart. Tim Soon-Massan, former Racial Discrimination Commissioner of Australia, had a altogether fantastic tweet. So... there's a bit of background here that I have to get to set this up. So the Serena Williams controversy, we talked about that. There was a Mark Knight cartoon. We talked about that with Janet Olbrechtsen. That cartoon sparked the international outrage and stuff like that. Mark Knight came back with another cartoon of him trying to draw a cartoon of Serena Williams and then all of these different groups telling him how to portray her and how to make sure it's not. And he's just sitting there in the middle going, can I just draw a cartoon?
Sweating.
That cartoon also got a fair bit of play. Tim Soon-Massan tweeted, the usual complaining about hurt feelings and playing of the victim card. When these guys vent about political correctness and any of these things, just remember it's narcissistic projection and part of their business model to feed off race controversies. I mean, for all of that, it's like, look, if anyone can recognize that, it's going to be Tim Soon-Massan.
Can you just say that last bit again for me, please, James?
I can indeed. And part of their business model to feed off race controversies.
Tim.
Your job.
Your
little paid position.
I think, you know, when you have like, I think a lot of political adversaries, once they finish up, become friends. I mean, I miss the days of Tim Soon-Massan as the commissioner.
Yeah.
Because stuff like, I'm going to miss stuff like this.
Well, we still get it. That's the point. He's gone. We're still getting the goal.
The usual complaining about hurt feelings and playing of the victim card.
business model to fit. Yeah, so...
Yeah, the hurt feelings and playing of the victim card is if, you know, similar to an action of encouraging people to come forward under 18C to complain about a cartoon, which is what Tim did to Bill Leake.
I think that deep down he's a bit of a troll.
I don't think that's trolling. I can't think that's trolling.
And I appreciate that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right, so you think it's a troll. I don't think it's a troll. Nina?
I don't think it's a troll.
2-1.
I think he's...
motion passed.
This has brought me and Tim closer together.
Has it?
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad. I would also say, like my last thing on this one, narcissistic projection. Great name for this podcast.
Yeah.
Great
yeah.
name for this podcast.
That's not bad.
It's
Should we rename it then?
Nothing will ever be waiting for our turn to speak.
Yeah. Kiboshed by the man.
But narcissistic projection, let's just keep that one close around.
Well, you know, it's a motto for life, isn't it?
Yep.
Okay, let's talk about...
To you, it's a podcast name. To me, it's a lifestyle.
Yeah, it's a way of life. So this is the most sort of European controversy I've ever come across.
Yeah.
There's this issue going on in Spain at the moment where a few of their politicians have been caught plagiarising their university theses. Which is interesting. Spanish Health Minister Carmen Montón, and I apologise if I've pronounced that incorrectly. I probably have. Should have got Bella to tell me. She's not in the office today. Not my fault. She was forced to step down over claims...
Can't fault him.
Yeah, you can't fault me. She was forced to step down over claims she plagiarised her master's thesis on interdisciplinary gender studies. That is the most European thing I've ever heard for a number of reasons. Firstly, it's the crazy... thesis topic. It's completely technocratic. Didn't have the morality to not copy other people. And most importantly, didn't have an original thought.
Yes. And then I would bring it to the state of European politics where someone is like, I reckon this interdisciplinary gender studies thesis is very similar to one I've read before.
That's true. Who's read more? And like, can't you just write whatever you want? Like, why do you have to, it's in this kind of interdisciplinary gender studies, surely you can write whatever you want.
Yeah, so there's just so many things about that. That's funny. I also found, so she plagiarized part of her end of course thesis, the one that gets from the freely available and internet online encyclopedia, Wikipedia.
Yeah. Is that what she...
She used Wikipedia and then put it in her thesis.
Wow.
Of all the websites. Like, they... Look, your teachers know about Wikipedia.
Yeah.
It's not like... Look at all this treasure trove of information. How am I the only one that knows about this? I'll never get caught.
And Wikipedia's a hot mess as well because so many people can contribute.
Yeah,
so it's
like
thoughts just run into each other. And
yeah, I think Wikipedia's kind of figured itself out until like something goes viral.
Okay.
Well, you know, it's pretty good.
Did they sponsor you, mate?
No. Look up Wikipedia. But the point is, like, you know, you've got to use like some other website.
Yeah, switch the words around a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Look, if you want to learn, Carmen, if you want to learn how to plagiarize, come to me and Pete.
Yeah, exactly. We know how to do it. And also,
how's your PhD coming along, Pete?
It is good. And to be honest, I do get stuff on Wikipedia, but I don't, I mean, I learn stuff on Wikipedia.
Yes.
Because there's lots of economic stuff on Wikipedia. But also, so we're talking about the Spanish health minister, basically because her thesis is funny. This controversy is also engulfing the PM.
Yes.
Pedro
Sanchez. Pedro
Sanchez. Which is not a very Spanish-sounding name at all.
No, I didn't think that.
And a couple, like I think the regional premier of the Madrid region.
Yeah, sorry.
Something.
Yeah, sorry. They're all plagiarizers, which is
so
just
rife. It's rife in the Spanish government. Anyway, keep your eye on that one. It should be a classic.
Yes, absolutely. We'll be with you every step of the way.
Yeah.
So come to us for Spanish health minister plagiarizing news. Your one-stop shop.
Mm.
Cool. Sorry. Another European story that I want to get to, Pete.
Yep.
So we've sort of talked about this before. We haven't been too present on it, but it is building towards something. So the EU has this... Aye. European Parliament this week has voted 438 to 226, pretty overwhelming majority, on a heavily amended version of the European Copyright Directive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a few of our younger listeners, their ears might be perking up at this. They might have come forward on this. Basically, this is like a restructuring of copyright law, especially online images, which is definitely going to have the effect of banning memes in Europe.
That's the upshot.
That's not the upshot. It's a downshot.
No, the upshot is the...
Oh,
is it not like, as in like...
I thought you were looking forward. I thought that meant you were looking forward to the death of memes in Europe.
No.
So a lot of technology companies and scholars are getting in front of them and saying, like, this is what the effect is going to have. So because, you know, like a meme is a shared image where the person who put the image up doesn't get it anymore, like doesn't get any of the cash. But you can't take my memes.
Well, I mean, I agree. What it's doing is, so online platforms are already meant to take stuff down if it's copyright, but it's making them responsible. What it means that it's not enough for them just to take it down if it's already up. They have to put in filters to block it in the first place. And apparently YouTube's been trying to do that and they haven't been able to perfect the filter. They've been knocking down heaps of stuff, which isn't subject to copyright. So it's having a negative effect.
Yeah.
And I also noticed it said that it could impact dating websites, which is interesting. Because, I mean, if you're using copyright images on dating websites, it's probably not a picture of you. So maybe that's a good thing. But
yeah, it'd be rough if it was like a Shutterstock watermark.
Really hot people. That's the Google. So, look, you know, we'll see how that unfolds. One good thing about this, though, is because it's subject to the EU bureaucracy, there's actually another vote. It's like another vote has to happen next year. Mm. It's like the third vote they've had on it. So get your memes in while you can, EU.
Yeah, just really get in there. It just occurred to me now, if copyright law is really getting amped up in Europe, I would be sweating bricks if I was a member of the Spanish ministry. Like, yeah, not exactly. Only do I have to resign, I might go to jail.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, this is what I mean. It's a big week for copying other people's stuff.
Yes,
in Europe, one of those weeks that I like that.
Cool. I've got another one here, Pete.
Yeah, you're on a roll, mate.
Thank you, man. Keep going. Thank you. That means a lot. This one was interesting. Another Europe story. The Dalai Lama.
Europe.
There's a lot of things.
Europe, that's the fact the Dalai Lama's from. There. Sorry, go on. Sorry?
No. I'm just saying there's a lot of things happening in Europe.
Well, you know.
We spent too much time together.
That's pretty bad.
We're going to have to take a bit of a break from the podcast.
Are you aware of the fact that Dalai Lama's not from Europe?
I am. But it is him talking about Europe. So the Dalai Lama has sparked anger. He's giving a speech and he says Europe belongs to the Europeans.
Yeah, okay.
Wow.
So that's what he says. He's talking about the migration crisis. He says Europe belongs to the Europeans.
What was the context? Oh, that was the context.
Yeah, basically the refugee crisis. He did say, you know, everyone has a moral standing to help refugees, but he did also say that Europe belongs to the Europeans.
Right.
Which is going to lead to something that will truly give me life, which is reading article after article calling the Dalai Lama alt-right. Like, if you're left-wing and you say that like that's an alt-right position...
Yeah,
you have to say the Dalai Lama is alt-right.
It's always funny. Yeah, that's true. And it's always funny to see these symbols of, like, you know, the left love the Dalai Lama, right? He's meant to be like this moral voice. And when he says stuff about Australia, they're like, oh, look, the Dalai Lama's saying this stuff about Australia.
Yeah, all of a sudden, law immediately.
All of a sudden, yeah, exactly. Yeah. All of a sudden now he says something that the left don't like at all.
Yeah, you thought the left turned on Jermaine Greer quickly.
yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, well, this guy's a, you know, white supremacist.
We need to look at his online secret groups. Mm. We need to see what he's posting on those places.
Now, what would the Dalai Lama be posting in his lads chat, I wonder? Like, that would be some reading.
I think there'd be a lot of spiritual oneness.
Yeah.
Exactly what the plans are for this weekend.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, anyway.
What the plans are for your next reincarnation.
Yeah. I was going to make a reincarnation gag, but.
Yeah, beat you to it with an inferior one. So I'm looking forward to those op-eds. Yep. Pete, do you have anything, or I can move on to another one?
No, I've got another one. Can we talk about. So the tweet by the ABC this week, a hilarious tweet about gender quotas.
Yeah.
Obviously, you probably would have seen it, but there's a Saudi delegation in Parliament and it had, I'll read the tweet, ABC Politics, at Politics ABC, a visiting Saudi Arabian delegation has a higher proportion of women than the coalition, hashtag AusPoll, and then the photo accreditation.
I think it was like two out of seven were women.
It's a small photo that I've got on my page, so I can't
tell. So it's like, it's this classic thing of like, the ABC, the independent, unbiased media organisation that it is, you know, just like the most unprompted attack at the Liberals. Yeah. Like, there was no reason to bring that up.
You're worse than the Saudis.
Worse than the Saudis.
When it comes to
That's a hell of a thing.
Yeah, look, for me, I don't mind.
They took it down like 2 hours later because it did certainly stir up a lot of ill will online.
Yeah, and look, I don't mind. I talk all the time about how you should be able to make a point and be a bit edgy.
Yeah.
You know, like
If it was a Sydney Morning Herald tweet, like I'd care because it was a stupid thing to say, but I wouldn't be like outraged. But the ABC, fellas.
And if the shoe was on the other foot,
yes,
it would be, you know, apologies and sackings, you know, and Twitter mobs.
Yeah.
So where's their apology? Well, if they felt the need to take it down, shouldn't they apologise for it?
Yeah, there was none that I saw. So, yeah. So Simon retweeted it, sickening, Simon Breeny here, sickening, the commentary from the ABC is a good illustration of the form of
is a good illustration of form over substance approach for those who practice radical identity politics. Behold the equality enjoyed by Saudi Arabian women, so amply revealed in this photo. Just don't ask any questions about guardianship.
Well, yeah.
Exactly. All right, so last story I want to get to here. So, coming up to summer.
Yeah, right.
The weather's good. It's been quite nice in Melbourne, if we can have a bit of weather chat. We are coming up to beach cricket season. Unless you are in the Tasmanian capital of Hobart, specifically the Clarence County Council, they have put together a controversial bylaw which requires people to obtain permits before they play organized outdoor activities in public areas, which does include beach cricket.
Mate.
A permit for beach cricket. That's where we're at.
Is there a reason why?
Well,
I mean, if the master
the government just doesn't like fun. If I can refer you back to the banning of memes.
I mean, if the master blaster myself is in, you know, no one's safe. But
let the surrounding suburbs barricade the windows.
Yeah. So look, I mean, obviously a few people got sconed in the head at some point. But I mean, a beach cricket's with a tennis ball, so it doesn't actually hurt anyone.
No.
You
don't need to get the government involved, for sure.
Yeah, can you please move?
Yes.
Would suffice.
You're on the pitch.
And like, you know, I mean, as a young person, I got told that a fair bit.
Yep.
You know, bugger off, mate. But well said, guys.
That's it.
No, what about
we got to stop ending the podcast on the one that's actually kind of sad.
Yeah, I mean, this one feels like we should just...
We should have ended with the Dalai Lama thing. All right, that would have been a good... Anyway.
This is what we call
live producing.
Yeah,
give you guys a bit of a taste of how the sausage is made.
But I'm sure that this will be backflipped.
Hopefully. So there's a vote coming up and the amount of coverage that it got hopefully gets struck down because it's a brave councillor that says, you know what, let's keep going with this.
I mean, if they do this, it's close the joint down territory.
Yeah. I need a government regulation on six and out.
That's fair.
Because it's always the debate at someone else's house.
Yeah.
Is six and out the rule?
I reckon it's out. It takes so bloody long to get the ball.
Yeah, but do you really want to hamstring triumph? Like, six and out to me is socialism. If you're too good, you're being brought down.
I think it's just sensible regulation because it's so easy to hit a tennis ball over the fence.
Yeah, you are just such an inner.
Spend your life bloody climbing the fence.
Nah, see, if someone's good, let them be good.
Cool.
So that is it for the show this week. Thank you to Andrew Bushnell and Matthew Lace for the interviews. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you're pre-ordering Matthew's book now. And thank you for listening. We're available on iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, etc. Make sure you're listening through any of the platforms that you want. Make sure you're getting your friends and family involved as well. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you're leaving a 5-star review. Now, Nina, if people want to get involved in the IPA, if they want to become members, where can they go?
Just visit the website ipa.org.au and click on the join button, and starting as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the loudest voices of freedom in Australia.
Fantastic. We'll see you guys next week. Go Dykes.
Say go Melbourne.